Blog Talk Radio.
Apparently, someone was trying to fix the show so it would start at its normal time. However, they were unaware that I was actually live on air at the time. So anyway, we're back now. The clock started all over. We have 2 hours on the clock plus an hour into the archive. And without any further delay, you guys that may not have tuned in earlier, my guest is Jayan Kazar. He is an author. He is also one of the leading specialists as far as the Bermuda Triangle. He has written a book called Recasting Bigfoot. So we're going to be talking about Sasquatch, and we're also going to be talking a little bit about the Bermuda Triangle. One of his books that he wrote was called Into the Bermuda Triangle, and another book also, They Flew Into Oblivion. Which, I'm not mistaken, is about Flight 19. So we're going to get him back on the air. We were talking a little bit earlier. You guys may have caught a little bit of that. And then the whole mess up. But we're going to get him back on the air. I got my co-host, Gene St. Gene, with Creature Replica. He's on here with me tonight. And we're going to get the show rolling again. All right, Gene, you with me now?
Yep. Through the magic of Blog Talk Radio, yes, Jayan.
It's crazy. Let me bring Jayan on. Jayan, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I deeply apologize for that. You know, there was an issue last week, and then again this week, and it's quite frustrating. Talk about some Bermuda Triangle shit right there, I'm telling you. Feels like deja vu.
Yeah, the show went right into the triangle that time.
I'm telling you. So before we got cut off, Gene, you were talking to Jayan yourself.
Yeah, I was talking for like 5 minutes, dude, and then I stopped and there was nothing there. I was like, oh, guys.
It wasn't my fault, guys. I swear it wasn't my fault.
No, that's fine. But anyway, where we were going to kind of go with it is one of the things I picked out of the book to maybe start as kind of the kickoff point for our discussion is that Jan Burns had talked about how the Indian tribes had described the Sasquatch as actually two different tribes of one of people and one of more of an apish primate, just to kind of put it in its simplest terms. And that I found to be interesting because it sort of, if there was at least two varieties of Sasquatch, then that would sort of explain why there's descriptions of the creatures that are more gorilla-esque, for lack of a better term, and or more like a human creature. And it would sort of explain why there's such a difference in some of the descriptions and that rift in the community where whether it's either an ape or it's a human species or some sort of a, you know, primitive hominid. But that might be a good place to start out because then you could also take it into the discrepancies between the foot morphology and various castings and prints and things like that. So maybe you'd like to take it from there, John. I'm not sure how many people who actually listen to the show are familiar with your theories and your work on this subject in particular, so probably a bit of a primer to kick things off would be good.
And I would like to know a little bit more of the history side of it because I listened to you on another...
Go ahead.
And I listened to you on another interview and I mean, everything you said about where the term Sasquatch comes from, I loved it. And if you can recap that, that'd be awesome.
Well, history is the base. That's where we have to start because long before the hype and hyperbole that came with 1958 in Bluff Creek, this phenomena had existed and Indians had spoken about it. Frontier journals had mentioned it. And without the hype, it's pure in history because it's not been muddled by theory, by anything, by grandstanding. No one really tried to explain all of these reports. You will see, you know, the famous Mount St. Helens case in which the artist Paul Kane wrote in his published in 1859 his journal about his event, his travel in the Pacific Northwest in 1847, and that's where we first hear about the Skookum. The Indians said that Mount St. Helens was the remaining abode of this cannibal tribe. They wouldn't go there. They were scared of them, and they weren't people in any real sense, but they were close enough to humans that the Indians would call them cannibals for eating a hunter that went up there. But Paul Kane tried to relate what they were saying, and he ended up in his journal using the greatest redundancy ever. And that is, he called them a race of beings of a different species who are cannibals. And there is, you know, that does that really clarify anything for us? But that's as much as he could understand of what the Klickitat and the Chinook considered the Skookum to be. Skookum as an Indian word, it's quite a popular word in Chinook jargon to this day, which is used mostly in Canada. In British Columbia, it means cool, macho. Or you even have a good-looking bicycle up there, they're going to say that's really Skookum. But it comes from the Indian meaning of swift and strong. So that's what they consider the Skookum to be, very swift and very strong. and very frightening. Athanoff, chief of the Klickitat, kept a terrible henchman to do his bidding at any time, and the other Indians referred to that henchman as Kathanoff Skookum. So it was anything that was just something they feared. And they had such a regard for it that Paul Kane would call them evil geniuses because he didn't really know what to make of this. And so here, that's the first thing we hear of the Skookum under that term. Then there's, of course, the Siotic that the Indians talked about, these tall, hairy, stinky tribe that were now reduced to conclaves and caves in the Cascade Mountains. And there's several other, you know, coming down to 1900, the famous kangaroo man of the Sixes National Forest that's in Oregon-California border. They didn't know what to make of him either, only that he was tall, frightening, close to 7 feet tall, they reckoned, hairy all over, and had wonderful aim with rocks and bombarded a cabin, and was known as the monster of the Sixes River. And in another case in which John McIntyre, a hunter around Lebanon, Oregon, was lost in the 1880s and never found again, hunters, I don't know, a year later or so, whatever, came across this hairy, what they thought was a man, eating a killed deer. And they were going to shoot it, but it looked so much like a man, and it bounded off so quickly, they didn't know what to make. And the only theory they could have is that it was John McIntyre, who had gone completely deranged in the wild and, according to the mentality of the time, could grow an entire body coat of hair and, you know, retrogress
so
from the wild man of the woods.
So they assumed that it was this man.
Yeah, so it was that human-looking. But then we have another report of what appeared to be a Skookum, and that was what the... it's in Idaho. Jean might remember it. In which it was the human monster of Bannock County,
mm-hmm.
Chesterfield or something, Chesterton, Idaho. And the kids were skating, and here was this huge thing suddenly appeared, and they were scared of it, and so they got out of there. And the parents finally came later, some of the town, to go hunt the thing, and they found clear footprints where it had stood, and it left a four-toed imprint. Now we come forward a bit more in time to Mount St. Helens, and we have the famous Gorillas of Mount St. Helens again in 1924 when the miners were attacked.
Fred Beck situation.
And after this incident in which they were sure that they had encountered the famous wild men, mountain devils as they were called, the gorillas of Mount St. Helens, they noted footprints about 19 inches long at one point, and they had four toes. And so first, though, that we as white men here in general of what this could possibly be comes from J.W. Burns, whom Jean already mentioned. And that is, he was the Indian agent for the Chehalis Indians for the reservation in British Columbia. And after years of hearing about Sasquatch George, which is what Sasquatch means, with the Indian accent, they'll say Sasquatch Chotch. That's how they pronounce Chotch. King George was Kinchotch. British troops were Kinchotch men. Great Britain was Kinchotch Edili, King George Island. And so George was so common a name amongst British at that time that it, in a way, came to signify man in a sort of a casual way, or probably a little more stigma to it that it meant a foreigner, because the British were foreigners. And the Indians...
John, one of these... sorry to interrupt for a second, but... Didn't one of the Sasquatch tribes actually speak the Douglas
yes.
dialect or something like that?
Yes.
So there was one of the Sasquatch tribes that actually could communicate.
According to Burns' article, when he first introduces us to that in 1929, was it, in McLean magazine? That's when we first hear some theory about what all these were, and that's when he anglicized Sasquatch to Sasquatch, so white man could understand it. Sasquatch is merely the district name. White man knew it as Chehalis, but the Indians call it Sasquatch, meaning mountainous region. And so he said yes in his article introducing British Columbia's hairy giants, There were two tribes of these ape-like men, and one could speak a dialect similar to Douglas, and the other apparently was just a very wild anthropoid.
I had heard that also, what Gene mentioned, that Native American tales, that these things could actually communicate in their own language similar to that of Native Americans.
Similar to Douglas, yes.
Right.
One tribe. This was one tribe, and the Indians insisted that the Sasquatch was the last bastion. Again, every tribe you come across in Pacific Northwest was sure that those they had encountered with was the last bastion of these, to them, degenerate people. The Indians did not wish to accept any relationship to these bizarre people, but because, one, they could speak something akin to Douglas, one of J.W. Burns' informants had to reluctantly accept there must be some kind of connection, which doesn't necessarily mean there was ethnically, but one tribe was capable of learning the local language. One of them, at any rate, the Indians of the Pacific Northwest were very international in mind. They're the ones who basically came up with Chinook jargon as an international language. And so that's how we first hear about Sasquatch. It was Sasquatch George, in other words, man of the Sasquatch, and it meant giant hairy Indians to the Indians. That's what they called them. And from there, we built up an entirely different legend in white man's, in our hands, because to us, giant meant 8 or 9 foot tall.
Right.
To the shorter people of the Pacific Northwest, giant meant 6 foot tall, and J.W. Burns clarified that 6 to 6.5 feet tall, but they were twice the thickness of an ordinary man. So that's what a giant was to them. White men started hearing this, and we started cycling these legends about this 9 foot tall, hairy Indian, and it didn't seem to mean hairy all over to us, the Canadians first, who really knew the most of Sasquatch. It's more or less a Canadian legend up there. To them, it meant an Indian with long hair on his head, but one that was 9 feet tall.
Well, right.
They
didn't understand.
Burns said it in his very first paragraph or something, hairy all over.
If you look at a lot of the old artwork, the depictions of these beings, they don't look like what you see in the Patterson-Gimlin film, and we'll get into that in a little bit as well. But they look more like the description that you just gave.
Well, there's a beautiful one in Washington, D.C., in the museum there. I did an artwork for it in my book. There is a beautiful picture online, which you could probably, if you Google Buquas or something. Buquas is the wild man. Sometimes you'll see an ape-like-looking mask, wooden totem.
Yes.
In this case, it's a wonderful human face, but it's not an Indian face. It's more a Negroid, but it isn't. It has thick lips, a normal thin nose, but it's definitely a human being, and this is the shaman mask of the Buquas. So even when it came down to the wild man of the woods, they had two interpretations, a snarling-looking anthropoid face and a disheveled-looking caveman, for lack of a better word. And so that plays into the two tribes that they spoke about.
Right. Right, exactly. And the Yeti, we believe, is something
totally different. Which is completely different, yeah. And that is what, if you say Bigfoot to any American, they are going to just call it the American Yeti. They're going to think it is the same thing, because early Bigfooters said it was the same thing. We have to remember today that Bigfoot was really not that popular. It was overshadowed in the 1950s and 60s by the Yeti. The Yeti was the big phenomenon. The Yeti had enchanted Britain since the 1920s in the first Everest expedition with Howard Bury, when the term abominable snowman was coined. And it was a big British thing that caught on around the world during the time when the sun never set on the empire. In 1958, in 1951, the Shipton photo, which is very famous, and anybody who follows cryptids know what the Shipton photo is. Dr. Michael Ward put his booted foot in one picture and then his axe in the other next to this very odd-looking anthropoid foot that Eric Shipton took on the Menlung La during his reconnaissance expedition, and it has become famous as the footprint of the Yeti, of the abominable snowman. And so in 1958, Bluff Creek comes along, and no American knew what to consider these big footprints. So it's just called Bigfoot by the loggers up there. And John Green, a Canadian, was already looking into Sasquatch, believing it to be real now, finally. He wasn't sure. He was hearing too much now as the centenary of British Columbia was coming along. People wanted to use Sasquatch as one of the native symbols because it was that famous in British Columbia. Their image of it, the white man's image of the giant Indian that stole Indian maidens, that's the image they were thinking of. But Green was getting information that from another sighting, the William Rowe sighting, that maybe this was what everybody was talking about in the Himalayas, a Yeti, an abominable snowman with a cone head, hairy all over. A young Schweitzer named René de Hinden came into his office in 1956 and insisted that's what it was. He even had Ralph Izzard's book, The Abominable Snowman Adventure, with him. Ralph Izzard was one of the leaders of the famous Daily Mail Yeti expeditions in 1954. He and the chief biologist Charles Stoner wrote a book, their own each book, on that famous expedition, and that gave us the Yeti as this cone-headed anthropoid, which could be Gigantopithecus. And de Hinden was completely swayed by that, and he believed Sasquatch was the same thing. And in his own book in 1973, he made no bones about the fact that John Green didn't believe him in the beginning at all. He said it's all a myth. Well, Green was starting to believe by this time in 1958. So he went to Bluff Creek in good faith to find out what was going on down there, because the Vancouver province had said a new Sasquatch is found, and so that registered with him. He goes down, talks to some of the loggers, is a bit suspicious, but after a couple of visits, he's fairly certain that something is really going on. Then he makes the equation. He says no one down there knew what to make of this, but, you know, anybody who had followed it knew that this was the Sasquatch. And so that's why we equate Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and eventually as this all unfolded through Green, through the other Bigfooters who were being very faithful to what they believed, but you know, they were wrong. They said that Yeti, Sasquatch, Bigfoot are all the same thing. That Yeti came with other animals across the Bering Straits land bridge in prehistoric times, the famous theory of migration, like other bears did and whatever. And so that basically this is the American Yeti. Sasquatch, Bigfoot's the same thing. It's a cone-headed giant that walks on two legs, and it's the same thing as the Yeti. And yet if you look at all the footprints, it's a complete impossibility. The Indians never described anything with a cone head. And footprints are the tangible evidence we have. The Sasquatch footprint was traced by a deputy sheriff in 1941 after the Ruby Creek incident. He crossed the line. He was a Washington State sheriff. He went with Gustav Tifting to this area near Ruby Creek in British Columbia, where a big incident occurred that scared the Indians. And he traced this long, about 60-inch footprint, which was a very odd footprint. It was deeply buried in the potato patch up to 2 inches. It crushed the potatoes underneath. And he made a complete investigation with one of the men who is actually came to help the Indians afterward, S.A. Tifting, outside Gustav. And that's where we get the tracing from. And John Green finally found Dunn's son in the 1950s and made a tracing of the tracing and put that in his books. And it's a genuine print from a time in which nobody thought of anything anthropoid. This was still white man's ideas in 1941 of the giant hairy Indian with just a tall guy with long hair on his head who kidnapped Indian maidens. And this is not a human footprint. This is not the Yeti footprint, which we have very clearly in Shipton's photo. This is not the Bluff Creek Bigfoot footprint, which we have in a clear cast that Jerry Crew took a picture of that launched the whole Bigfoot phenomenon. They are not the same feet. They're all real. They represent something different. I say the Bluff Creek one is a hoax anyway, but certainly the Ruby Creek one is not, nor is the Shipton print, and we have two distinct anthropoids just with that. And so, but today you're not going to hear that. You're going to hear this one species, Gigantopithecus. The Yeti is Gigantopithecus. Sasquatch is Gigantopithecus. Bigfoot is Gigantopithecus. They're all the same thing, and yet they have radically different footprints.
I mean,
and the human aspect is completely lost. The whole idea that there are two tribes is lost.
I'm a researcher myself, and even I know that there are many different types, if you will, many different species. For example, what is described as Sasquatch in the Pacific Northwest is totally different than what is described in, say, South Florida, or even here where I'm at in Mississippi.
But that will not be accepted in general by the Bigfoot community. Bigfoot comes down to us by folklore, by American folklore, as the cone-headed American Yeti.
Yeah, because they want to put it all in a nice little box, and you know they want to have it all in a nice little box. I mean, it's hard enough for them to come to the conclusion and admit that there is one, even one, unknown hominid living in the United States, let alone coming to the admittance of there's not only one, but multiple different species living in the United States. Or in the world, for example.
That's because, well, you know, you can understand that mathematically it's hard to believe that there's several species running around that have never been captured. What people have to remember is that no one really goes and looks. That is fiction, that there have been expeditions to go look for these. Yes, there were 250 Sherpas with the Daily Mail expedition going up into the Himalayas, and I'm sure that many people scared anything away.
Oh, I mean, I go look every night. You know?
Tom Slick paid to have guys go into Bluff Creek, into areas where it was very dubious that anything had been going on. Even Yvonne Saunderson finally admitted that Bluff Creek reeked of contrivance. But the actual areas where the Indians said Sasquatch was Morris Mountain, the British Columbia area, no expedition has gone there. Nobody has gone looking for the true Sasquatch because the Canadians thought it was just a giant Indian, and that didn't make sense. That's reeked of folklore. And no one wants to believe my other assertion. Well, I shouldn't say no one anymore. My book has influenced quite a lot of people. But I don't think anybody really suspected that we were dealing with a Native American anthropoid for a lot of these reports. They wanted to believe in some evolutionary missing link back in the 1950s, and that had to have some link with the old world. And so that meant something from Eurasia. And that's all they wanted to believe in order to ennoble, I suppose, their quest, that they weren't simply looking for an anthropoid. They weren't simply looking for an undiscovered type of primate. They were looking for the famous missing link. And most of Indian artwork actually can be, you know, really distinguish an American features on primates. And yet you'll hear the case of Amaranthropodus loisi, as it was known, Mr. Loy's ape-like American, is a famous case from South America. I took a picture. After two of these primates, according to Francois Deloy, the head of the expedition, looking for petroleum, and they came across what were, to them, two apes walking on their hind legs. They were about 5 feet tall. They were getting real rancid. They were ripping the sticks off, branches off, and beating leaves, and shrieking, and then finally they defecated in their hands and threw the uninviting confection at the group. And that was all they were going to take. And so that's when the female The male stepped forward. Francois Deloy cocked his gun and fired. The male had just stepped aside, and he downed the female. And the male was wounded and ran off, and they couldn't find it. So they bring her body back, stick her on a fuel crate, take several pictures. But eventually, you know, they're out there looking for petroleum. The body is disposed of. Most of the pictures are lost except this one famous one. And in 1920, when he came back and showed this, the world didn't want to believe it, because nowhere in any theory, as it stood at that time, would they accept that something as they saw in that photograph could possibly exist, because that photograph shows what is basically a 5-foot-tall spider monkey, although it's more developed. And since only one photo survived shooting from the front, you couldn't see if it didn't have a tail. Deloy said it didn't have a tail, that this was an ape. It was not a monkey. It walked on its hind legs, and it was not a monkey. And you can do measurements from the crate. One French scientist did. And he said it is about 5 feet tall. But that caused a huge stink when George Montanon introduced this as Amaranthropodus loisi in 1929. And he said this is a real Native American ape that is extremely similar to the spider monkey. Has a Platyrrhinian nose, which only Native American primates have. It has these other features that are more anthropoid, although it has an obvious, you know, relationship to the spider monkey. And so that's been condemned. Yvonne Saunderson hated that whole idea. He said it was a hoax, and they brushed it aside. But if you come northward, the Mayans
I'm looking at the photo right now, and there appears to be male genitalia on it.
That's female.
Yeah,
the spider
female,
monkey has
a very developed, female parts. Not to get too fine a point on it, but that's a feature of the female.
Wow, that's scary.
Yeah, and that is...
Yeah, imagine that coming at you.
And so you can imagine why they thought it was just a spider monkey, because female spider monkeys will have that feature too. Everything about this said it was a spider monkey, but Deloy said it was an ape, and the picture shows something that's close to 5 feet tall, and spider monkeys are this dinky little quadruped with a long tail. When
you know,
I come north...
Interesting. You know, it's interesting, John, about Sanderson's stance on the Deloy's ape is that... I'm in the middle of reading his book now, and in the section on South American extant hominids, or however you want to look at it, he specifically talks about three different types of these type of creatures in folklore and sightings and things in South America. So he was behind the idea of these type of things existing. He was just
if they were from the old world.
Yeah, he was vehemently against the idea of the Deloy's ape specifically, because he didn't buy the photograph.
Fit his theory. He wanted these all to be subhumans. Deloy's
right.
ape obviously is not. It is a primate. It is a primate akin to monkeys, and we have never seen that.
To me, it looks like a mix between a spider monkey and a gaboon.
Well, it was, Philip Goss, who was a naturalist as early as, 1834, what was it, said that in South America there may exist a larger primate undiscovered than the Oriental, which back then meant the orangutan, and the African, which back then meant the chimpanzee, because they didn't know about the gorilla. So these stories were coming out about a primate, about an ape-type creature in South America, long before Walter Raleigh even heard, stories about this. And Pietro de Sieta de Leon also heard stories about these, and that they're noted for their howling and their whistling. And that's what the Indians down there always said. They travel in pairs, and they're always noted for their howling. And then you come north to the Indian artwork of the Pacific Northwest that has been so frequently used as proof of Bigfoot. Every Bigfooter has used this thing. Look at these ape-like features. Look at these rocks that Othniel Marsh discovered in the Columbia Valley.
Mm-hmm.
This shows that Indians had a knowledge of ape physiology. And how do you explain that unless this is their cone-headed Yeti again? And yet that's not what those masks show. That's not what the rocks show. They show very specific features, always and the mask's a howling mouth, like it's whistling, whistling or howling, puckered lips. That's the Desonequoi, as the Indians call it. The eyes are always surrounded by a huge ridge, so that it looks like this thing is wearing huge round glasses like Howdy Doody or something.
Right, right.
And it has a howling mask, howling lips. And it's a hairy creature. One, the Kuskomo Indians call it the Hami, and there's his full bodysuit that has short legs. An Indian is wearing it, long arms, big hands, and this Desonequoi howling mouth with these eyes surrounded by this huge round ridge that completely encircles the eyes and goes down to the nose. That is the Deloy ape. That is exactly what you see in the spider monkey, the bony ridge that does not just stop over the eyes but goes all the way around. And these masks repeatedly show Desonequoi like this. They show Amaranthropodus loisi. They show what Francois Deloy was condemned for. Supposedly he would make a hoax deep in Venezuela when he was looking for petroleum. He went in with 20 bravos. He lost every one but four. And he came out lucky with his life and with his picture that remained and showed it saying, you know, I'm a geologist, but I think this is a significant find. This is what we experienced. Here's the picture. We stuck it on a crate. And it didn't fit with evolutionary zoological theory at the time, and that's why it was so condemned. But you look at the Indian artwork, and that's what it shows. You look at Mayan statues. They show ape-like creatures, both showing male characteristics, although clearly one is a female. And you look at how they would have migrated up from, well, they would have come from South America through Amerindian country, you know, Mayan, all that, and left an impression there. Then up the mountain ranges of California, Sierra, Nevada, and the Rockies, or they would have gone through Texas to Florida. My contention is the Loisi is the skunk ape. And they, you know, they would have then impressed the Indians.
That does sound possible. I mean, the build is pretty much the same. But, you know, Gene and I were talking earlier today. excuse me. I'm sorry. We were talking earlier today, and, you know, there's always these theories that Sasquatch came over the land bridge, or even now something came up from South America, which I have no doubt that something could exist in South America with the Amazon being so unexplored. But here's the thing. Why do they have to come from somewhere? Why can't they have originated here in the United States?
Well, nothing pops up from the ground. So it has to originate from somewhere where the land was to their, you know, to their adaptation. And considering the artwork and, you know, were you saying that they migrated to South America from North America?
No, from South America to North America
Right. That's what I'm saying is that there's more than one Native American primate that's been mixed into the collage we call Bigfoot.
Right, right.
It's not the cone-headed Yeti. We're talking about Desonequoi. In my book, I make contention that Desonequoi was never Bigfoot. These masks that we use, that Bigfooters used quite sincerely to prove Bigfoot, actually shows Deloy's apes, and this is not the true Sasquatch. This is not what we would ever consider Bigfoot. This is what the Indians always said was Desonequoi. They're people or wild things that, you know, in the forest. They're not mountain creatures. Indians always said these are the forest creatures.
Okay.
And they almost always understood that these were not people. These were animals. And that's what Desonequoi shows. It does not show Bigfoot. We have said it shows Bigfoot. But it actually shows the same thing Deloy took a picture of after he shot it.
Yeah,
and
because
this is purely Native American.
Many of these masks that I've seen, the nostrils are almost identical to what this picture I'm looking at of Deloy's ape.
Yeah, Platyrrhinian. It has a ridge down the middle of the nose, which is a cartilage ridge that divides the the nostrils. That would be a Platyrrhinian nose, whereas old world primates, including man, have a Cotterinian nose. We have a downward pointing nose, nostrils. But all new world primates have and those that is separated by a cartilage in the middle that is depressed.
Okay.
That it's a groove.
So
that's what these masks show. And what I'm saying is, once again, it's not Bigfoot. This is Deloy's ape. This is a 5-foot-tall, crap-flinging anthropoid, which we have mixed into the Bigfoot makeup inaccurately.
Okay, so then the question...
The prints that are analogous to, like, the Ruby Crank print with the longer heel, that would be something more like this type of animal would be. Correct?
No. This would be Old World. It's my contention that's an Old World, that there is what the Siberians call the Dawn Man or the Terek, that did come over according to our theories. And that, again, the Tungu, the people that speak about this, say it's 6 to 6.5 feet tall, just as the people of the Pacific Northwest say the true Sasquatch is.
Okay.
We say they're 8 feet tall. Only rarely does one get that big.
That was going to be my question. What is, I mean, we explained the Deloy's ape. What is, in your opinion, or your theories, what is Bigfoot? What is the true Sasquatch?
I would say the true Bigfoot, let's say, and Sasquatch are not the same. That Bigfoot would be a Native American primate, though it is not Deloy's ape. It's just another species. And the true Sasquatch, not the human tribe, but speaking purely of anthropoid, would be this Old World anthropoid that the Tungu called Dawn Man or Terek. And that is what William Rowe saw in 1955. That really began to convince John Green these were hairy all over. These were not giant human Indians. This was something hairy all over. But William Rowe once as well said this was only about 6 feet tall that he saw, but it was twice the bulk of a man. And so, again, that was very much in line with a legend he did not know about. And that was on Mica Mountain in the Canadian Rockies. So that would be the true Sasquatch right there. He described the foot like the Ruby Creek print. It has a long foot with a narrow heel. And that is Sasquatch. That's what brave Peter Williams said in the 1929 article by J.W. Burns, that the Sasquatch that chased him was the more anthropoid one, and it had an unusually long foot. And this one could not speak. This is Sasquatch. This is not Loisy. This is not a human. This is not the human tribe. This is not the skunk ape. This is not a Native American at all.
Is that the, when you say this is Sasquatch, is that the image that America has come to recognize as Sasquatch? The big, broad
shoulders? No, because it doesn't
have
a cone head.
Okay.
So take something without the cone head. The female does not have a sagittal crest. William Rowe was clear, just has a sloping head. And the male would not have any noticeable cone head either. We're talking something much more human-like, considering its footprint. There's no offset toe like a thumb. Apes basically have four hands.
Now, is that also
an elongated foot?
Is that also what we know as Bigfoot?
No.
So that's a totally different... Man, that's a lot to remember. You need to write a book or something.
What I try to do in the book, not to confuse people that I'm saying so much, I try and let them know that Loisy is not a part of it. I go through so much to just separate Loisy from all the confusion. It's the Indian artwork for the most part. You will encounter some masks that are very much more ape human-like and are certainly not a Loisy, like the Tamishian tribe mask.
Right.
But the Loisy is not a part of the equation. Throw that out. Desonaqua is not a part of the equation. That is a primate that will, I think, one day be genuinely cataloged as a Native American. They'll call it an ape, I'm sure. Anthropoid. And it's not Bigfoot. Some may like to call it that. They'll always, if one of these is finally found and brought in, it'll be 5 feet tall, very lean. It'll look like the giant spider monkey in the picture. And the press will be hooting, oh, this is the real Bigfoot, this is the real Sasquatch. It's just a Native American ape.
So far we have, I'm trying to keep count of all the different ones that you met, Yeti.
Yeti is purely the old world. Yeti never came over.
Okay.
Yeti is the size of a 14-year-old boy, according to those who have seen it.
Right,
he has an
right.
unusually tall cone head with a bristle crest down the center like the Celebes macaw.
So I'm at about four or five different ones that you've mentioned. Is that correct?
Yeti would be only over in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
So in America, there is only two, if we don't count the Loisi, which is merely an undiscovered, officially undiscovered primate. Here would be Sasquatch and Bigfoot. And Bigfoot, to me, and Skookum are one and the same.
And skunk ape, you think, is the Loisi?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're not counting that one?
No. Because I think that's really not, we're not talking about something that is so phenomenal. It had an 8 foot like the rest of them with an offset toe. It's phenomenal because it shows us that anthropoids akin to monkeys can exist. But it is not this giant human looking thing. It can never be confused for a human. And as I say, the Indians didn't say Tsonequah was a human.
So just from talking to you tonight, I mean, in my mind, there's ape, then there's the Loisi, and then you branch up to the Sasquatch and the Bigfoot. If you're looking at it like the tree, for example.
What tree?
Well, the species, the different branches of hominids.
Well, the Loisi wouldn't be a part of that. I wouldn't consider that a hominid.
So
I think that would simply be called. If that's ever finally captured, that'll be considered a species, a new discovered species, and they will call it an anthropoid or an ape.
Right, but what I'm saying is there's so much being said about Sasquatch being the missing link, and how do you go from ape to a Sasquatch, and the Loisi ape would fit right in between there, wouldn't it?
No, not really, because it's a more developed monkey. So you have a lateral variation rather than any kind of transspeciation.
I think all of these,
but it's bipedal,
all these
right?
All these different variations
largely
would have broken off much earlier on the divergence from between where hominids and apes sort of split off millions of years ago. That would have been branched off much further
right
back then. You know, so that's why that one would have been some sort of offshoot of the monkey or ape tree rather than having any sort of association with what became modern humans.
So we're aware of the Loisi ape.
Go ahead,
Gene. We're aware of the Loisi ape and its appearance. There's Sasquatch, Bigfoot. What are they in your mind the differentiating appearances between those two?
Between Bigfoot and Sasquatch?
Yes.
I'll let John tell you. He sculpted one.
Well, yeah, I know Gene sculpts, but...
Well, he knows the features.
Well,
he knows what
I think
I'm talking about.
You know, John had talked about how the Bigfoot would actually be more akin to what he described as the Skookum, with the flatter head, more of a... What he described
Bulldog's
is
head.
Kind of an anthropoid version of a howler monkey. Am I
on
the right track there, John?
Mm-hmm. According to the descriptions that we have from Northern California, where the Skookum or Oma were centered, there's that Happy Camp report that described that you know, howling 7-foot-tall creature that's known as the Wild Man of Marble Mountain, and it had a bulldog's head, which is a like the howler monkey. It has a cleft, you know, in the hair parts from the center part.
Mm-hmm.
Has four toes that mark.
Which is very, very, very much like Gene's sculpt of the Skookum, correct?
Mm-hmm. It's taken from that, from a developed howler. And remember, Sasquatch or Bigfoot is known for its loud howling as well.
One of the other interesting aspects in the book, John, was your analysis, again, to go back to kind of the footprints, your analysis of the way some of the footprints present themselves. I remember you'd gone through an extensive kind of description of how when certain monkeys walk, the offset toe will actually not leave an impression, and then you get an impression of a four-toed creature when actually there may be a fifth toe that's just not setting down.
Yeah, because they walk on the outside of their foot, not the inside, so the toe, offset toe, would be on the inside. And then there's cases where, you know, someone is like Mike King was at the Lumber Maverick, saw one of these and he didn't know what it was and it ran off. And it left a long footprint with long toes, spreading toes. And then there's reports of squat toes. And, of course, you know, they're just walking. Sometimes those monkeys just bend their toes under. And when they're running, it's out flat and they have long little finger-like toes. So that could explain some of the variations. But it's the footprints, the only tangible thing we have. We can argue about facial features and overall build just based on what people say. But tangibility is found only in the footprints, and that clearly from frontier accounts and the Indian accounts gives us the Ruby Creek print, which is very humanoid, but it's not human. And that's five toes, and then descriptions of the four-toed Skookum with the cleft, the bulldog type of head. And so there you have something very different in a four-toed, a creature with a very thin hips, and in something that's very thick all around like the Sasquatch with a small head. Sasquatch is said to have an unusually small head for its size, but it has a very long humanoid foot with five toes. They're almost equal across. They're not a human foot with the little toe going way down at an angle. They're almost all equal across. So those are two very different footprints. And
wow.
That argues for more than one species about in America alone. And both are described as rather large, 6 feet to 7 feet, some of them, and they're bulky. And again, none of these are Deloitte's. That's out. That's out of the picture. There's two other things, aside from humans. So when you boil everything down and want to get rid of everything and try and fit something close to what we have as the legend of the giant American Yeti, you come down to this old world Sasquatch and this American Bigfoot with four toes, the Skookum.
Right. Gene and I, when we talked earlier today, and we do that pretty much every week, but there's a report or a story that I had heard about early settlers coming to the Americas and encountering large hairy men over, I want to say Maine or maybe Massachusetts. Are you familiar with that?
I think there's New York, Sackett Harbor, remember that report? Where the hunter, and what was that year?
Oh, hell.
One of the hunters saw a creature that resembled the wild man of the woods. There's, again, two different species being discussed.
And they
a hairy
went back.
Creature.
Yeah, I think they were camping out one night, and if I'm not mistaken, this thing terrorized them, and then they went back, got some buddies, and they all went out there and they shot it.
That's an Arkansas report, isn't it?
I might have two confused and put together, but the one that I'm thinking of, it was a reenactment. I think it was Monster Quest or one of those shows I saw it on. These guys are in early settler clothes, and they're in like a canoe, and they go to this island to hunt, and they're out there camping, and this thing just terrorizes them. I think it kills one of them or something like that. And eventually they shoot and kill it.
I'm not aware of that one. I know the Sackett Harbor report. I know reports of wild men of the woods. And back then, again, it's like the John McIntyre thing. They thought these were people that got lost, separated from their farm. And they retrogressed. They became hairy all over. In the Sackett Harbor case, as I said, this thing approached the hunter. Then it ran away, and he was able to describe its feet. It ran on its hind legs, stooping forward, and it had very narrow heels, which is like the Sasquatch foot, the Ruby Creek print. But it said specifically this was an animal that resembled the wild man of the woods. So this
right.
was two things are being implicitly, well, one explicitly, this is an animal, implicitly that there was a wild man of the woods. And again, that's what the Indians are saying. There's a human and simply an anthropoid involved, one so close that it's confusing.
Well,
I
have to ask. I have to bring another cryptid into it. Dogman. What are your thoughts on it?
Brother-in-law. Dogman. You mean in India, the Dogman of India?
No,
I'm
thinking.
Means in terms of like the Michigan Dogman and kind of
right.
the. It's kind of more of a modern werewolf folklore in the United States.
Like, what's the disease
like,
called? Hypertrichosis? What is it?
Hypertrichosis.
Face Boy Dojo, the dog face boy?
Yeah, there's some
yeah,
of
or,
that,
or
but
even,
there's also... There's
can you imagine
also
really
growing
seeing
folklore.
Someone like that? You know, we shouldn't try and diminish the mystery of actually seeing someone with that either... There is a disease, but then there's also the genetic variation. There's people
no,
who
no.
acquire that.
This is supposedly a cryptid that looks like a werewolf. It has a snout, has big wolf ears. Gene did an action figure very similar to it of the Louisiana Rougarou. And supposedly people are seeing this werewolf that they call Dogman.
I don't know. You know, zoology is full of freaks. Just look at the lemur.
Right.
That's a primate with a dog or a bear's head, with a wolf's head.
Right, right.
And it has primate's hands. So something undiscovered can still be out there that's very bizarre or could have inspired werewolf type of stories. I tend to think it's a variation that is cataloged, but, you know, it's pretty frightening to come across a human being that looks like people that have that variation, that hyper, whatever it's called, trichosis, where they're hairy all over, you know.
Well, you know, the question, even back in the early days of settling America, the question, and even with the Yeti, the question remains is why has it, in Deloitte, for example, why has it been kind of swept away, swept under? Is it because of religion? Is it because if it doesn't fit into, you know, what certain people think our history should be, that they're not going to address or acknowledge it? Do you think the government actually knows about these things?
I don't think the government knows much. No, I don't think the government knows about anything like that. I think it's sort of so rare. Most people do not go out into the boondocks. They're rare for us, and if we don't see it, we tend to disbelieve it. They were common enough for the Indians to make all these masks of wild-looking humans, like the one in Washington, D.C., in the Native American Museum, a mask of what is starkly like Deloitte's ape, rock heads that have the same circumference around the eyes like Deloitte's ape, like spider monkeys. Other strange wild man masks that look like some kind of ape-like man. But for us today, it's very rare. And so we tend to just not believe it until we see it.
Well,
some people need it spelled out for them.
Right, right. I, for one, based on communications I've had with, I know with wildlife officials, really believe that the government is aware of these things.
Well, who's the government? Fish and Game?
Well, yeah, I know that a lot of those guys are aware of them. I don't know. I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to say the government like Obama or Men in Black, but there are officials higher up than we are that are aware of these.
Well, I think there's
I think a lot of people believe in them.
People in the government that have had experiences with them and are aware of their existence. But it, in some cases, to bring something like this forward is a career killer. And in other instances, you know, there's really no point to making their own jobs more difficult by attesting to something like this.
Right, right. Okay, let's talk the Patterson-Gimlin film. Your thoughts on it, Jayan?
Hoax.
I'm sorry, you broke up.
It's a hoax, as far as I'm concerned. It's the image of the Yeti, as Patterson understood it by the folklore of the time, the cone-headed giant that Chernyshevsky endorsed and the pictures that he drew in the 50s, and that's what Saunderson always said they had a bullet head, and I know that Patterson had contact with Saunderson and believed his works, and so it's not what the Indians described. It's not what frontier journals describe. This is a cone-headed, and in a very good suit.
Well, images I've seen of it, she seems to have a sloping head. I wouldn't go as far as to call it coned. But I'm interested to know, why do you think it is a hoax? I mean, all the musculature moving and so forth.
Well, that's one thing that Roe and the others who saw these close-ups said. There was no muscular defined. It was round all the way around. And it had a foot with a very narrow heel and a very different type of foot, like the Ruby Creek print. And Patterson's Bigfoot left footprints that were remarkably similar to Ray Wallace's hoax prints around those areas. They had just flat, funny, enlarged human feet.
Okay.
And
well,
that
Dr.
was a terrible mistake.
Didn't Jeff Meldrum study the print taken from Bluff Creek and verify that it did come from a living?
Well, that's very willy to try and do that with the prints that Titmus took. I wouldn't agree that it's completely chronologically inconsistent with the entire... So he can say what he wants, but to look at a plaster cast 40 years after the fact or something... of something that is so much based on the misperceptions of the time instead of the actual journals, the actual Indian artwork, the actual Indian stories.
I'm torn on the Patterson film, to be honest with you, because some things about it I think, okay, that's real because of the muscles moving in the arms and the back. But then you get to the waistline, and there seems to be a defining line going across the waist, like where a shirt and a pants might meet. To me, they're
bending a gator on the thigh.
And I see not one, but I see two in that film. When she turns, there's another something in the background that leans out, and I mean, do you think they had the technology at that point in time to be able to create a suit of that caliber?
If they just built up the padding in the back, yes.
The only aspect of that that always intrigued me about the Patterson film is I think they made too much of the fact that that Patterson had all this skill as an artisan. Back then, the materials were much more difficult to work with. And the thing that always intrigued me about the film, to me also, it always just looked like a bad gorilla suit. But the one thing that always struck me is as you see the back shot as it's walking away, I could identify every muscle group on that back in some of the clearer shots in the film. And that, to me, that's not something that some amateur could do in his garage, you know, at the time that that film was done with those, with the crude materials of the time, you know. And that was the only thing that kind of struck me. And then some of the newer investigations by Bill Munns, where he examines it a little closer, that throws just a little bit of wrench in the monkey works, a wrench in the works as far as the total hoax theory as I originally looked at it. But there's too many convenient aspects to them being out there at the time and getting the film, and again, just the way it looks. But I think it's going to be one of those things that even if they found a suit that they actually attributed to it, it would still be very hard to verify that that's what it was. And the guy that claims that he built the suit, Philip Morris, has never been able to reproduce anything near to it. And there's certainly a lot of things about Bob Hieronymus that are equally as squirrely as Roger Patterson. So I think it's going to be one of those things that's just going to go down in history as something that's indeterminable. You know, I think there's a lot of things on both sides that are intriguing.
The circumstances about it are also very suspicious, as DeHinden relate. He would believe it later, but he was very frank in his book with Don Hunter about how he arrived at Bluff Creek right afterward. He was in San Francisco, and he took them by surprise. And according to Patterson at the time, they took the film. They were there. He said, "Why are you here?" And Patterson explained it, that they got out of there after they filmed this. They took the film without developing it to Eureka, which was quite a drive back then with those mountain roads, mailed it off to Washington without having it developed, alerted the world press to all this, not knowing even if he had good film or not. And the reason why they were there, they came back, is they went back into Bluff Creek to protect some of the footprints.
That doesn't seem suspicious to me. I mean, if I were out there and I had a camera and there's a Sasquatch Bigfoot walking and I'm pointing the camera at it, I'm pretty sure that, and I know it's working, I'm pretty sure that I caught it. So I think even I, in my excitement, would be like, guys, wait till you see this. I've got a Sasquatch on camera. So, to me, that doesn't seem too suspicious.
It seems very suspicious to me, considering they came back just to look at the footprints again, supposedly, and take pictures or, what was it, cover some of them, and they barely got out of there because of a storm. And so they discouraged DeHinden going and looking. Then 9 days later, Bob Titmus turns up, and he doesn't see any sign of a storm or a flood there at all, and he's following these footprints. You look at the film, it does look like it was not filmed at the exact same time as they were there by the colors of the leaves. So there's a lot of suspicion why they went back just to, you know, why they rushed out of there, then came back just to go do something with footprints.
Well,
so
I mean, could it be that the
suspicion is that they went back and made the footprints and already had the film developed, shot a couple of weeks earlier, and then they made the announcement in Eureka.
Well, could it be that they were just trying to protect their find, their area? Because
you go a couple hours away with undeveloped film and then you come back. That's very rugged country up there to this day. So you drive to Eureka.
Yeah, but you just discovered Sasquatch. I mean, of course you'd go back. I would camp out there. MK
but nobody
Davis,
did. Isn't that interesting?
Are you familiar with MK Davis?
Yes.
He does. He did some analysis of and Jan, please understand, I'm not trying to put you on blast or anything like that. You know, we're just trying to discuss our different views on it. He did some great analysis of the Patterson-Gimlin film where you could actually see the footprints left by whatever it is, the subject in the film.
Well, the subject had to leave footprints.
Of course.
Are they the ones that were later cast?
I don't know. You know, in all honesty, I wasn't there, you know. You know, so I don't know.
But these are the wrong footprints. They're not the Sasquatch footprint. They're not the four-toed.
Oh, I see
footprint.
What you're saying. I see what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. That
they
was the huge
cast,
mistake.
They didn't cast
because they thought
the
this was
footprints.
The human. That is correct.
I got
but
you.
But this is not the Yeti footprint, which is very distinct. This is not the Ruby Creek Sasquatch footprint, which has been traced and which was described in all these other journals. Very narrow heel. The toes are almost even across in front. This is a funny, flat, enlarged human foot. And it doesn't fit anything.
I misunderstand. That's
what I'm saying. The footprints are the big clue. Forget the film. Forget the ape. Forget whether you think it's a suit or not. It has wrong footprints. And these footprints are inspired more or less from known hoaxed footprints by Ray Wallace in 1958, his hourglass footprint that had the same funny type of toe line. And we know that Ray was talking a lot with Roger Patterson. Roger Patterson was a true believer. He believed Bigfoot really existed.
So
and
it
he
is
thought
possible.
That everybody thought these hourglass footprints back then were real. John Green believed they were real. You know,
right.
The
so
things
it is,
that
it is,
you know Ray was running around in.
So in summary, it is possible that the subject in the Patterson-Gimlin film could be a real Sasquatch, but the footprints that they cast weren't from that subject.
Well, they certainly don't. They're certainly not the Sasquatch or the Yeti or the Skookum footprints. These are completely, you know, enlarged, funny human footprints.
So you're saying that now...
Not what Sasquatch has.
Right now, in this day and age, all the footprint casts that people turn in with the five toes, you're saying all those are hoaxes?
If they're just an enlarged human foot, they are. Because the Sasquatch has five toes, but they're not human. They're almost even across. It's a very long inhuman foot.
And this is this.
And that's
this
not
based,
what Patterson.
What is this based on? Is this based on theory, or is this based on?
No, this is based on the Ruby Creek print tracing, based upon the descriptions when seeing the wild man has an unusually long foot with a narrow heel, and that's what we see in the Ruby Creek tracing by Sheriff Joe Dunn. And that's not the footprints that the Patterson-Gimlin film subject, Patterson-Bigfoot, has. It's not what Bob Titmus cast. He cast 10 footprints.
And they all
Patterson
have four toes.
And Gimlin cast a couple of them. And are definitely not.
They all had four toes, right?
They all had five toes. These are just funny enlarged human-based footprints.
Okay.
Not these are mostly the human-type foot that you see in the majority of the castings.
Okay, I have
to... Skookum has four toes.
Okay.
Skookum has an inhuman foot. Sasquatch has an inhuman foot.
Now, the four toes... I have to ask. I've talked about this before, and I have to ask. The four toes, was it many prints that they found with the four toes, or was it just one foot? Because
many
what I'm saying is, what I'm asking is, is it possible that one of these things might have lost a toe due to, say, maybe a snake bite, due to an infection, and it bit it off, or due to fighting? Because we know that chimpanzees, they bite fingers and such. Or was it actually... Both feet had four toes.
Both feet have four toes. Okay. And it's more than once over periods of a century that these type of footprints, some were cast in Manitoba. One was photographed there in 1973, the Mount St. Helens. Gorillas, quote-unquote, all had four toes. The human monster of Bannock County in 1902 had four toes. This is not a single incident.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to be either a defect in a certain genetic line or just a totally different species, as you mentioned. I mean,
that's not Patterson's Bigfoot, had five toes. They were enlarged, funny human prints. They're not the Sasquatch foot. They're not a Loisy foot. They have no offset toe. They're not Skookum.
So those prints surrounding Patty are hoaxes, is what you're saying.
Are a terrible mistake. They're based only on the belief that this is something with a flat, enlarged human foot.
But that's still,
makes it
right.
The film makes it look like a cone-headed Yeti, and the Yeti has a totally different foot as well, as we see in the Shipton photograph.
Could Patty be something else entirely different?
Since it's May, you know, it's made to look like the Roe encounter in which he described the female with large breasts. It has the cone head of the Yeti. It's a strange amalgam. I would say it's just hoaxed in that fact that he just turns up out there with his camera ready to film when he does.
So it's not possible that
no one has ever filmed anything again.
It's not possible that these things may have interbred at some point.
No, because then, you know, interbreeding is not... You mean hybridization like the mule?
Similar, yeah. I mean, if you're a creature out in the woods, you're going to take the first thing that comes along, whether it's, you know...
I don't think all of them.
Well,
it's
not like they have a Sasquatch version of eHarmony.com out in the woods, you know?
No, the Sasquatch is really a completely different, you know, it's set through time what this footprint looked like and what they looked like, and that there are two species, and one is not the cone-headed creature at Bluff Creek, where, you know, what's that based on? All the 1958 reports from what we know Wallace was doing?
Right.
The prints that Jerry Crew showed were one print, and then Wallace, Ed Chambers, made it plain that that's the print he was shown, the hourglass print, and Dale Wallace showed us that foot, you know, over a decade ago after Ray died. Ray and his brother Wilbur were doing a lot of hoaxing, and
well,
that's what made Bluff
question.
Creek so big. And so
and
here,
I'm sure...
Patterson goes to Bluff Creek, where there never was anything,
right,
and
right.
films this thing with a similar foot to Wallace's.
Well, I have to ask you a question. I'm sure our listeners are probably thinking the same thing. If it's a hoax, why breast?
William Rowe described them in detail.
Yeah,
William
that,
Rowe's account
that,
is what anchored everything in 1955, and he described the female with breasts, and that makes it a very believable thing. Except Patterson didn't know that a female wouldn't have a sagittal crest. What?
Didn't his book actually have a drawing of a female in it that matched the Patterson?
His daughter, yes, Myrtle Walton, drew that under William Rowe's auspices, and John Green had published that in his advance.
But why go that far for just a hoax?
Why
you know?
Not? Believable,
I know, but if you wanted it to be yeah. believable, if it was a hoax and he wanted it to be believable, in my mind, you know, nowadays people know to shake the camera and all this other crap. In my mind, if he wanted to be believable, he would have been closer to it, and the camera would have been much more steady if it was a hoax.
I think the problem is, though, is that if he was closer, you know, devil's advocate here, if he was closer, it would probably point out anything that would come off as, you know, shoddy suit making, you know?
Yeah, but I mean...
That could be why also. If you shoot shaky cam footage and you're like however many yards away, it's going to be a lot harder to poke holes in it definitively.
That's true.
And look at when the Sasquatch, quote unquote, turns its head, you'll notice the neck does not move. Mm-hmm. The neck padding on the back of the shoulders and the neck does not move at all. The hair doesn't move.
On Patty is what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No, if you wanted to promote a hoax, put details that no one would suspect. I mean, this is how William Rowe described his encounter.
And why did he follow it even more? I mean, if it was a hoax, you know, you'd think he'd have followed it even more back into that corner of the woods. you know, or gotten closer. Even then, he, you know, he, if it was a hoax, he would have moved and gotten a little bit closer. I don't know, man, you know.
Well, if it was a hoax, he wouldn't want to try and expose himself. If he believed this, why did he nor any other Bigfooter ever go back to Bluff Creek and stake that place out? They never returned. They went, John Green went a year later to try and figure out if that film footage was real. A couple hunters went out there and took pictures, but there was never any expedition staking that place out. Patterson never even went back. He went to Oroville. He went over the whole Pacific Northwest trying to use the film to gain money. But none of these Bigfooters ever went back to Bluff Creek. That is one of the greatest paradoxes in any pursuit. This, when that film footage was taken by Tim Dinsdale at Loch Ness, the place was surrounded by people with telescopes and everything trying to find the Loch Ness Monster. There were mobile homes set up. There was expedition out there.
And, of course, that famous
image. But
at
Bluff Creek, nobody goes and does that.
That famous image turned out to be pretty much a submarine, a very small
whatever.
Port.
I mean, the reaction was logical to what they believed. They believed it was Nessie. They came by the droves to try and find it. And here, this is being promoted in Bluff Creek as Bigfoot, and no Bigfoot ever goes back out there. There's no bases set up. There's no telescopes on mountain shoulders scanning the glades. No one ever goes back. And yet, if you believe the Patterson film, if Patterson believed it, here is not only proof of Bigfoot. Here is proof of Bigfoot at Bluff Creek.
Well, you know, I have to admit that I'm on the fence with it. There's some things about it that make me think it's real, and there's some things about it that makes me think it may be a fake. Like I said, at the waistline, there's a clear black shadow going completely around the waist. The ass looks padded way too much.
It's very baggy when he's walking. Have you noticed how it increases when he's walking?
Right, right. And then there's the bulge on the thigh that some scientists tries to claim as a herniated muscle. I'm sorry, but I don't think you'd be walking normally if it was a herniated muscle that big. I don't know, man.
Like,
I mean,
walking in a gator.
But, you know, like
a gator will curve just like that, a hunting gator.
Yeah, those muscles on the back, the shoulder muscle, the bicep, the tricep on it.
You know, it looks like padding to me. His elbow bends out at a 90-degree angle at one point. How do you do that?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived
with
Sasquatch.
Yeah, I think the only thing
that'll, definitively
decide anything is if someone finally comes up with a capture or a carcass, if the creature ends up looking like Patty, then I'd say it's probably, you know, a strike for the Patterson film. But if they don't capture something that looks like that, then it'd be something else. The thing that'll be interesting is if something is captured or killed that looks absolutely nothing like that film, I will bet you that the scientific community at large and also the skeptical contingent is going to say, well, that's not Sasquatch. Sasquatch doesn't exist. You captured something
too.
Else.
Yeah.
They'll use it as an excuse to negate the whole thing. So I think the Patterson argument's an old one. I don't think it'll ever be definitively solved. You know, there's still too much ambiguity on both sides of it.
Oh, we're definitely not going to solve it tonight on the show.
No. Well, says you.
regardless of the Patterson-Gimlin film being a hoax or 100% factual, we do know that in the Pacific Northwest there are Bigfoot and Sasquatch, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
there were.
So the bottom line is that remains. Now, in my lifetime, I've seen three in three different occurrences. I've seen three of these. One was in Florida. In the panhandle, and two were here in Mississippi. I've seen eyes shine, here and there. Recently, I've had one roar at me and a friend of mine. The ones I've seen, as I told Gene earlier today, we're always at a distance. They did not look like Patty. They did not look like what you see in the Patterson Gimlin film. And the main characteristic that was different was the fact that they were not built like a bodybuilder. The height was there, the wide shoulders were there, but there wasn't all these bulging Lou Ferrigno muscles on it. On any of the three that I've seen.
What was now, the head like?
Well, that's what's so odd is the one in Florida, it was at a distance. It was kind of the color of dead pine needles. Down in southern Mississippi, it was black. And to me, it looked like, and it was the middle of summer. In fact, it was about this time of the year. To me, it looked like someone in all black, one outfit, you know, like jogging with a hoodie. And I watched this thing get up out of a ditch and go across a gravel road. And it was probably at least 100 yards, maybe even 200 away. And I went over there. I got my roommate, his son. I got him. We went over there. Didn't see anything, but the smell, I mean, we smelled what smelled like pig farm and wet dog and like horse piss all rolled into one. And
well, that's a nice visual.
Well, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. It was pretty rank. And then the third one I saw was actually in, I was in a vehicle and it was in passing. I saw it kind of on a slight overpass, and it was down in the middle, crouched down in the middle of a gravel road. And instantly, you know, I knew what it was. There was no mistaking. It was pretty close to our vehicle. But they did not look anything as far as bulk like the Patterson Gimlin film. And you know, Gene and I talked about this earlier. Perhaps the terrain has something to do with it. You know, for example, the skunk ape has been described as being very slender. That makes sense for the marshy, swampy areas to be more slender and lighter, whereas over in the Pacific Northwest, going up and down Rocky Mountains all the time may lend a little bit to the bulky size. And again, it's all speculation, of course.
Well, you could have a thin creature that simply seeks out environment conducive to it, and you could have a bulky one that prefers the mountains. It's not
there
that the environment made them like that. They're like that, and they will seek out what is the most, you know, the best environment for themselves.
There you go. Could it be that they've existed this long in certain environments that they have evolved and adapted size-wise to fit that environment?
Or even just regional variation.
We live in the genetic age.
Regional variation. In areas that have a lot of primates in South America and Africa and things, there's just regional variation in animals. You know, all different variations of monkeys and apes and things like that. It could be just a case of that across the United States. I mean, it's tougher to believe.
The same thing with humans.
Here. Right, exactly. It's tougher
That's
to
right.
believe here because there's no fossil record, and there's no evidence of any of these creatures that's rock solid where you could prove it prove it definitively. I think that's the biggest hole in the whole thing, is if there's this many variations of creatures across North America, and there's no body, no evidence of a concrete nature. I mean, obviously, you can describe an animal officially strictly from footprints, but something that's this rare it's more difficult to, you know, they're not, no one's going to buy that as definitive evidence. So there could technically be variation, but it's harder to believe because there's nothing to document it.
Why do you think that is, Diane, the elusiveness?
Bipedality. They can simply move much better than your average ape can move. And from the Indian accounts and from white man's accounts, except for the Loisi, they appear to be mountain-dwelling creatures, and mankind is not a mountain-dwelling creature. We simply aren't going to encounter them that often. So they may not be as elusive as we think, but you have to remember, you know, who really goes and looks.
And then there's also...
Hopefully they could be retreating deeper into the forest, too.
And then
yes,
there's
and
also...
Further up north into... you know, British Columbia, where it's very sparse up there, but it's some of the thickest forests on the continent.
And then there's also
for me, the most
difficult
things to believe are where there's sightings in very, very populated, human-populated areas. Those I find more difficult to believe than the ones where they're out of more remote locations. You know, that's, but again, it's how do you sort through them? All of it is such anecdotal evidence. You know, maybe you get footprints cast here or there. I mean, you could sort through it, like you're saying, aesthetically, depending on which footprints you believe are legitimate or which are obvious fabrications. But it still boils down to, you know, a house of cards until there's a body.
Well, there's another species that we didn't mention either, the Janasqua. Where does that fall? Yeah, the rock ape.
That was a little hard to believe. That's like that reminds me of like the Sting from the Fantastic Four. I don't see where that would necessarily fit biologically, unless it was a creature that rolled in the mud or something.
I don't think camouflage. Right. I don't think that they're. I can't think that their skin is rock, and the folklore doesn't say that they don't have hair. It just says that their skin is rock, and perhaps their skin is just gray and cracked and appears like rock.
But you know how some Aboriginal tribes will paint themselves with mud and things like that, and they'll sort
that's
of
right.
appear stone-like?
That's
hey,
right.
John, you know what we're talking about? Are you familiar
no.
with this?
No. My the most esoteric is the Traverse Bean Gorilla. That's what I secretly have been collating
really
information on, but no one really talks about the Traverse Bean Gorilla and its
John,
similarity to the Falk
up.
Monster and to
not
what
the,
Alan Berry was talking about in the Sierras.
You are familiar with the Janasqua, right?
No, some rock ape, no.
Why don't you give them a
there's a point where
I'm
run down on what that is, Brian.
All right. I sent you right now the cryptid wiki site, and it says basically excuse me, the Janasqua is a type of Bigfoot mentioned in Native American folklore as Rockman. It is reported as Bigfoot's larger, bulkier cousin. It has rock-hard skin, and they twist the heads off their victims until they are decapitated. They are more aggressive than their cousin Sasquatch. And that's about it that they say on that site. But
is that like Skinwalker legend or something?
Oh,
there's many Indian legends, and you have to be careful how you dissect them into truth.
Yeah, all of it is, you know, a lot of this is based off the Skinwalker theories, but this is supposed to, the Janasqua is supposed to live in caves and underground, and it's one that is described as going in and stealing the native women. Here's another site I'm going to send you. And they're very, very violent. And you know, this whole, the missing 411, David Pilates, a lot of people theorize that that's what's taking these hikers and, you know, causing all the harm. I mean, that's a total other show, of course, but...
I prefer when there's tangible correlation, there's data that you can correlate over a period of time. That interests me, like the Traverse Fiend Gorilla. Now it was described by the people up there in the 1930s to Elliot Merrick, and then to later to Professor to Bruce Wright, who wrote his book Wildlife Sketches Near and Far in the 60s, and he was able to go talk to the Michelins up there. And then you have, you know, it's a strange foot. Merrick said he saw the tracing when he went to visit and has three toes. You know, that's nothing. That's not an ape. That's not a primate that we know of. And then you have the Falk monster supposedly had three toes as well.
Right.
And that no one back and then even remembered Elliot Merrick's old book, True North, in the 1930s. And then you have Alan Berry in the Sierras, where he recorded that that funny sound, you know, in his tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the prints they found were three-toed. And John Green, when he wrote the foreword to Berry's book, he said, "I just prefer that those three-toed prints go away," because he couldn't explain them. Here you have three-toed...
Do you think that those three-toed prints could possibly be explained by what you're talking about in the book, where the certain types of apes will walk with some of the toes folded under, or if they're walking on, like, the lateral edge of their foot or something like that? Do you think that's a possible explanation why the foot
is just, it's like a sloth's foot. Seen the three-toed sloth's foot?
Uh-huh.
That's more or less what it's more or less like. It's not half a print. It's not an angled print. The weight's only on one side. It's just a narrow, long foot with three big toes. And it's a grayish color.
Yeah, the thing I read about it was a grayish white. Didn't it have a mane also, kind of a whitish mane?
Yes. Well, I mentioned that old show to you.
Mm-hmm.
The Honey Island Monster,
yeah,
in
Island
Louisiana,
monster, yeah.
And that's described as the same thing, that grayish color, and it has three toes.
Okay.
Believe there's a giant three-toed sloth, bipedal tree, three-toed sloth walking around, but it's interesting that all these independent lines converge.
Right.
Yeah.
Wendigo.
The Traverse Fiend Gorilla was really quite real. It terrified Traverse Fiend.
Wendigo is, that kind of got thrown into the whole Sasquatch thing as well. However, the story is based on something totally different. Right?
Yeah, that's unrelated. As I understand it, the Wendigo in Native American lore is basically a wind spirit that takes over people and brings this sort of an evil entity into them that becomes cannibalistic, like uncontrollably hungry, and they would become very emaciated and, you know, go on kind of killing sprees and things, whereas in pop culture, the Wendigo has become more of a creature than kind of an evil entity, and that's where you see... You know, a lot of times you see them, they're almost werewolf-like, but with hooves and stag horns and more of a deer-like head, but, you know, feral. So I think that particular feature comes off as a little differently depending on whether you're kind of looking at a comic book version of it or a traditional folklore version where it's more of a demonic spirit. But you know, a lot of these things, a lot of the different folklore, I think potentially a lot of things that are seen and are described as different things, like the even the lizard man, there's some speculation that could even be just a swamp version of a Bigfoot, you know, kind of like the spout monster, but just so covered with swamp, you know, moss and things like that it's being misidentified as something other than an ape. I think the three-toed thing also played into that for the Fog Monster and for the Lizard Man, because potentially, you know, lizards would have less toes on their feet than any primates that's been, you know, that's been described.
Right. Guys, we have 19 minutes left of airtime. Now, we can always go an hour over into the archive. Real quick, Jayan, is there anything that you want to plug real quick?
In 19 minutes?
Well, like I said, we can keep going.
We haven't talked about the human aspect here.
Right,
that's
yeah,
a big deal. That is the one
definite
tribe of the two tribes. One was human, and that's what's really been lost. And that's not lost in Russia. The Russians did the same research into their stories of the snowman or the wild man, and they came to the conclusion that humans were involved because they had the case of Zana. And they certain she was, by their understanding of the times, that she was a Neanderthal. And Professor Porchneff even went and visited the village where she had lived, met her grandson, Shalikula, saw him, you know, that he had mixed features, slightly Negroid features, and saw him, you know, pick up a chair with a person sitting in it, and he picked up this chair with his teeth and lifted them up. That's how strong his neck muscles were. And this is the grandson of this very strange woman known as Zana, who was Negroid and hairy all over and was described as we would, in the days of our innocency, describe a caveman. And she was strong. She could outrun anything. Dogs hated her. She stank. Apparently not too much, since she had half-breed children, as they called them. And she had four children. And so, you know, what was Zana? Obviously, if she could breed with human beings, she was human.
What was the name of the male?
But you want to get into hybridization, which I don't like to.
What was the name of the male son that she had?
Kodazar was the girl. Kavit was the youngest one. He's the one that there's a picture of. I did a drawing of him. There is a picture of the son, Kavit, and very, you know, Negroid features. Looks a lot like that mask in the in Washington D.C. of the human wild man.
And they went back and dug. They went back and dug his remains up and did a DNA sample on his teeth, and it showed to come from Africa.
Sub-Saharan. They did DNA tests on descendants, and they decided that Zana was 100% sub-Saharan, but then they speculated that she was still not linked to any other tribe. So, and there were features in his skull that showed Neanderthal-type features, although by the, you know, the parsing of science, she could not be a Neanderthal because they're Eurasian, not African. But then again, you know, the features were remarkably similar. So they won't say Neanderthal, but if you're just, if you look at them physically, wouldn't they look alike? It's maybe darker. But they got into the details of sub-Saharan as opposed to Eurasian, but it doesn't change the fact that physically Zana was not like any African anyway. And she certainly wasn't slave material. She wasn't a slave. And I don't know why people think every time an African is found where they don't expect him and has to be slave transportation, Africans can migrate on their own.
Right. Any population can migrate.
And so here you have Zana now finally shown to be 100% sub-Saharan, but still, from the definite examination of her son, traits of Neanderthals were seen. And certainly her grandson was something completely unheard of. If he could do that, and Professor Porchneff saw him do it in person, I mean, pick up a chair with a person sitting in it with your teeth and then lift them up. That's not a normal variation that we know of. And that's what Charlie Victor, the brave Charlie Victor in J.W. Burns' first article introducing B.C.'s hairy giants, he said this is what the woman was like that he encountered. This is a 1929 article in Canada by, you know, talking to Chehalis Indians, and he said this woman who spoke to him, this creature, that's what it was, he said. She was a Negro black. She was about 6 foot tall, but twice the thickness of an ordinary person. She had hair all over. She was nude. They always go around nude. Her hair went down to her waist. I think he's describing Zana exactly. That's how the Russians described her.
Hmm.
And you see that Indian Buquas mask of a human. A human Buquas mask that has no Indian features, but Negroid features. And this is, you know, then you see Kavit's picture. That's why that's in my updated book. I'm going to put those two next to each other. They look the same. These are very different people. These are not African slaves who were carted off to the Caucasus Mountains. These are a very separate type of people who immigrated on their own way back when. And even Barry Sykes, who did all this work, even speculated later on that the Telegraph article, or what was it, God forbid it's the Daily Mail, but the news articles when this first came out, the DNA test, she could be the last of an ancient migration out of Africa when, you know, there was a people like this. Just everything about the wild men of Dagestan or the Caucasus is that they cannot handle heat. They can only handle the cold. She slept in a cold room. She slept out in the barn or something.
The Dagestan man
that they captured could not handle a heated room. The Sasquatch people could not handle heat. They lived up in the mountains in the cold. From the evidence, a lot of Neanderthals obviously got along in the cold.
So that's also why we tend to think that the skunk ape is actually Loy's ape.
Because it likes the heat of Florida, or maybe the swamps and bayous of Louisiana, or the forests of the Pacific Northwest, which would not always be that warm, but they were not, of course, mountain-dwelling creatures. The Dasonaquah were always just forest people or forest creatures, depending on what tribe spoke about them. They portrayed them all looking the same, but they were not mountain people. They were forest. Forest dwellers is what they would call them, not people. So those, once again, that's not a part of the human equation. The humans were the other Sasquatch tribe. They were the other Sasquatch Georges. Indians describe that one human tribe being able to speak, but looking incredibly different than Indians. And as I say, they described what the Russians heard described and what they saw in the descendants of this Zana, who actually did leave now DNA for us in her descendants. But it doesn't match really any tribe. It's just that she was 100% sub-Saharan.
Right, right. You know, I was hoping to be able to talk a little bit about the Bermuda Triangle tonight, but I'd love to get you back on for a future show regarding that. I haven't read your book. I'm hoping that it falls in the category of the paranormal. And your thoughts on it.
What?
Cheyenne?
What?
I said I haven't read your book, but I'm hoping that your thoughts on the Bermuda Triangle fall into the lines of the paranormal to get you back on and discuss it.
Me into the paranormal? Probably not on that subject.
Okay, so it's not like what most people think, the whole UFO alien.
Bigfoot?
No, the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, I catalog everything that I can. There's a lot of documentation. You would have to read it to see where it lies. I don't like to consider it paranormal, but I discuss UFOs in detail, and I'm the one who discovered the other only case where we have documented that an aircraft vanished after the pilot panicked and mentioned a weird object. There's the Fred Valentik case that's quite famous, but I actually uncovered one, documented it, and even got the audio of the Mayday from the Triangle, and the aircraft vanished after the pilot panicked over a weird object interfering with his aircraft. So there's a lot of that. I consider that very real and not paranormal. It's just unexplained. So there's Edgar Casey's Atlantis discussed in ruins.
Right.
Many theories. So you would find the triangle very different from my approach to Bigfoot.
Okay, I got you.
I try and be the commentator and remove myself and report everything that's factual and relevant without showing my bias. That's the one book where I was not trying to be the investigator. I obviously did investigate, but when I presented it, it was to be as objective as possible.
Okay, well, Gene, are you okay to continue? Diane, would you like to continue?
Now?
Yeah, I mean, with Sasquatch. Continue
the
show.
Yes, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
Sure. I got time if you guys do.
Yeah.
You sound like you're asleep.
I'm actually working as we're talking.
Hopefully,
are you taking pictures for me of something?
Sculpting something good.
Are you taking pictures of something for me?
Oh, not yet. Those things I was talking about, I haven't even opened the boxes tonight. I'll do that later on, because then I got to screw around with the camera.
Okay.
Yeah, I am anxiously awaiting Gene's action figure line to debut.
I'm looking forward to him doing another cryptid. I don't know if he wants to talk about it. He probably doesn't. But I think he might do another one.
Well, I think he might do a lot of other ones, I hope.
Well, I have a specific one in mind. He doesn't want to talk about it.
I don't know. That's up to him. Yeah. Gene.
Or he passed out. He must have passed out.
Gene, are you still with me? Oh, it dropped him. Gene's call dropped. Gene, call back in. He can't hear me. What the hell am I thinking? I got a message.
He's on Facebook right now, so just message
him.
Yeah,
I got him. I'm interested to find out what it is you're wanting. I know I'll find out. I just don't think I'll find out on the air. Okay, he tried to call in. Hold on, he's saying he's on hold, and no, he's not. There we go, now I got him. Gene, you there?
I'm here now.
All right. So, yeah, Gian, go ahead and repeat. Gian was mentioning a cryptid.
Gian.
There you go. He was mentioning the cryptid that he would like to see done. And
which one was that? I dropped out during that.
I said you probably wouldn't want to mention it. I didn't mention any names. I just said I'd like to see a certain cryptid done in a new line.
Was it me and you talked about?
It probably, yes.
Yeah, don't say it then. It's probably something I'm doing.
Then I won't say it.
Yeah, it's probably something we are doing. But, it's funny. Me and John have talked about this stuff so much. We kicked around a lot of ideas on this, too. But there's so many things that you could do. I mean, just initially the line was going to be all Sasquatch-type creatures. It was going to be the Yeti, the Yowie, the Sasquatch, and the Orang Pendek. And then we decided to move the wolves into the line. We decided to broaden it some more. So and just to go outside of the kind of ape-man relic hominid thing, there's so many interesting cryptids around the world. There's no need, we're constantly being asked about the Mothman and the Jersey Devil and Chupacabra, and there's so many things beyond that I don't want to get stuck just doing the main ones that everyone expects. So the second line is basically going to be a bunch of stuff people are not going to expect. I mean, we already announced that we're doing an alien gray in But there's three other things we're doing in that line that are going to catch everybody by surprise. And that's sort of, that's what we wanted, though. We can always go back and do, throw each one of those other kind of more typical cryptids in along the way, but there's just, whenever these type of lines are approached, it's just they do the same thing over and over and over, invariably in a very unimaginative way. So I think that the longevity of the line, it's going to be important to do some more interesting things and stay out of the pitfalls of the kind of a typical crypto line.
John, are you into other cryptids, or is it mostly just Bigfoot, Sasquatch?
There are certain. I was led onto something due to a murder investigation, the Skinwalker murders in Arizona.
Oh wow!
So, which were never solved. They go back to the 80s.
Right.
And that's what they're called because one seemed to be ritualistic, and there was blamed on a legend. But the flying, the Mothman type thing, the gargoyle, the origin of the gargoyle in America is something I've tried to get information from in the Southwest from Apaches and so forth, and trying to find what creature really could have inspired, because the Indian legends do speak of such flying things. And I really don't follow the Mothman at all. You can tell me what the most logical explanation ever given for that is, but it's the origin of gargoyle that I find interesting.
Obviously,
the reptilian
you've seen that old
type of
movie, right?
What?
You've obviously seen that old Stan Winston movie from the 70s, right? Gargoyles with Bernie Casey.
Oh yeah, that's with Cornell Wilde.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah. And so that is, what is the origin of the Indian image of that, the bat-winged large creature? There's supposedly no such bat, or certainly a bipedal bat that could land and do that. And so I don't know what the Mothman was supposed to be. I really didn't follow that. I know someone said it was some kind of large crane or something that was out there.
Well, then you have sheep squatch, and you have bat squatch, and
bat squatch. Yes, that's something I've heard of.
And I don't know. You know, I think at some point people's imaginations kind of start to run wild.
Yeah, it can get very common.
Is it a pterodactyl? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the pterodactyl, wouldn't that be kind of like a thunderbird, kind of a offshoot of the thunderbird mythology?
Mm-hmm.
Possible, like an extant pterodactyl, explaining that to a degree.
Right, that's what I was thinking,
too.
Supposedly
in the 80s, one was shot in Arizona.
Oh, like that old photograph of the Civil War guy holding it up?
Something like that. There was supposedly one shot as late as the 1880s in Arizona.
You know, it goes back, Gene, to what you and I were mentioning earlier today, is that the adrenaline, you know, these people who claim that they see a bat squatch or sheep squatch, or hell, even the dog man, for that example, could be a case of their adrenaline getting the better of them and adding to something that wasn't really there.
Yeah, that's all very variable. A lot of people, even if they're sincere, they're very subject to, you know, they're easily impressed.
Well, you know, you get people who, back to Sasquatch, Bigfoot, you get people who think that these things have telepathy, that they're able to zap or cloak, disappear in and out of dimensions, and you hear some of the craziest stuff, and it's like, I know no other animal species on the planet that can do any of that.
That's deeply rooted in old Amerindian legends and so forth, and beliefs in animals could do that. I don't really even follow that. I'm after something very real.
That's
all the
right.
work I put into it is not for mystery. I'm looking for something I can get and prove.
That's
without
right.
killing
now,
it. So, you know, when people try and that's what turned so many people off. So many people were following Bigfoot in the 1970s because it was still something attainable. That guys went out with their Elmer Fudd hats on and their horn-rimmed glasses and their Scotch plaid flannel shirts to go hunt, and it was a sincere image. And then suddenly when, you know, presses needed more chapters for the phenomenon, that used to be a very lucrative phenomenon, we get to hear now about explain why no one ever got one. Well, they're shapeshifters, they're doing this and that, and aliens come and take them away. And
right, it started as excuses.
Yeah, the theories are just excuses, and they become a new chapter, and people are having psychic communication with them, and you know, I don't want to get into disgusting stuff, but, you know, women are trying to, never mind.
The tabloid aspect. Bigfoot
the tabloid aspect.
Child.
Which has a basis in actual actions on some people.
I think when an actual creature is finally captured or a carcass obtained, a lot of people are going to be super disappointed when they find out it's just a flesh and blood creature and not
exactly.
Like some sort of a supernatural being. You know, I mean, because that's what it is. I mean, it's the perfect excuse. We can't catch one, so it cloaks. Got predator abilities, and it can do this, it can do that, and
that turns off the mainstream.
Yeah,
and then by effect, it reduces everything else they give them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to ask.
It just makes everything look bad.
You know, you said a little while ago what you're looking for. So I have to ask: are you going out into the field? Are you? Aggressively out there in the field searching for Sasquatch.
I have been in certain locations, and next year I hope to devote far more time for it. I have to get myself back in shape, and I think I'm going to do two things to do that. Go up Mount St. Helens just for the hell of it and look for the old cabin location. And I think I'm going to get myself in shape in the woods again by trying to find D.B. Cooper's landing spot.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Which I think is in the Washuga, as most people now think, but I have my own theories about that based on where the money was found.
Well, I saw something not too long ago about him on television where supposedly there was this guy that looked identical to him. They overlaid the images and really thought that this guy was him. Are you familiar with that?
There's a number of names. Was that Weber? Or was that...
I don't remember the name, to be honest with you.
Seeing the picture, I really don't think he made it. I think to identify him, you'll have to find the head, skull, and still, how would they trace those teeth? I mean, that would be very difficult to try and find who this guy was, but he obviously tried to get back to Portland where he came from for that flight anyway. He had to have some arranged landing point. You don't go to the detail that he went and then just, you know, opt to bail out of an airplane and land in a muddy field somewhere and then hitch a ride
right.
In a black muddy suit with a big bag of money under your arm. So he had to have been going back to a place where he felt he could have got into a car he parked somewhere, a cabin he rented, motel room he rented.
But you think he
something.
Didn't make it?
I don't think he did because of the money that was found in the Columbia River bank at Tina Bar. And it's not just because money was found there, but why three bundles were found. I have my own theory right now as to why three bundles would stay together, and that would indicate to me that he did not make it.
So perhaps he got caught up in the trees or some. I mean, people go missing in the wilderness all the time, so there's no telling. But
parachutes don't go missing that much, though, especially his color, if it opened. But then the bag of money, he had the briefcase with him, which he might have simply pitched on the way down, thrown it. You know, he doesn't need the briefcase. It supposedly had the bomb. But no, I think the factory bundles could stick together, which just to, you know, the rubber bands were still there. But there's a point where decay reduces them to stickiness, and they'll stick together. If anybody has a heavy amount of documentation, you've seen rubber bands when you pull up the pages. They before they dry and brittle, they become sticky and they stick together.
Yeah,
and so that indicates that three bundles stuck together indicates that there was a certain amount of decomposition that occurred while all that money was still together, 21 pounds of it compressed, and whatever caused it, snow, rain causing the bag to finally shift or finally decay enough that a few bundles went sailing down into the Washougal River and then into the Columbia. Otherwise, three bundles are not going to stay that close together in a river unless they are stuck together by semi-decayed rubber bands.
Are we sure that this money came from the D.B. Cooper incident?
Oh, yes. The serial numbers matched.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yes. It's definite. So to get myself in shape again, I think that would be fun because I don't have to do much mountain or deep forest, I don't think, to get myself in shape. You know, when with Bigfoot, I'm not going to go out on my own. I like to try and get some guys with me, but that's always difficult.
Hell, I go out.
A lot of data gatherers.
I go out on my own nearly every night. You know, I've got some good recordings here and there. What I believe to be the communication. And interesting enough, there was a guy I was talking to a couple of days ago who was telling me, he's like, oh, I went camping over there, you know, in your area near where you live. And I was out one day, and I was walking in this certain area and heard some screams. And what is so interesting about it is this guy described, without me ever telling him, described with pinpoint precision the one particular spot that I get most of my activity. And that's far, far too similar to be a coincidence.
You have recordings?
I have some audio recordings, yeah.
Can you put those up on the web?
Yeah, I put them on my site too. And there was a video I captured not too long ago. I don't know what's in the video. The crypto crew took it, slowed it down. Appears to be something small in a tree and something larger on the ground reaching up to grab it. You know, I can't say with 100% certainty that it's Sasquatch, but it's interesting nonetheless. I've got audio of tree knocks, howls, some kind of language, and I'm back there at least 5 miles from any kind of dogs or anything like that. You know, two words that stand out with the communication is sounds to me like moi moi, and then it goes on into further syllable sentence type structure. I don't have the, you know, really, really good audio equipment as far as cleaning it up and so forth. But Gene, you there, Gene? You still with us?
Yep. Yep. Monitoring your progress.
But yeah, I posted all this on my group page. I've got a SoundCloud also, if you're interested, and the video, of course.
I'm middle-aged. I need all these links sent to me. It's hard for me to find them.
All right, I'll be doing that over the next couple of days. I'm going to try to send you some links right now. I'm trying to get Gene. I told Gene if he ever gets down here to let me know, because I definitely want to get him out there.
Yeah, my problem is his time to be able to dedicate it to go out and actually do some of this stuff, you know. So that precludes me from even worrying about whether I'd actually be in shape to do it physically.
I have to get in shape for the Pacific Northwest because I have to hit the mountains, get in shape to go up and finally try and penetrate closer to Morris Mountain. No one goes there, and that's the center of it, according to the Pitjahalas and the Salish. Morris Mountain was always the center of both tribes. They were always at war. That's why they reduced their menace to human beings. Morris Mountain up there is the big deal, and no one has ever bothered to try.
Isn't that where they described that area as almost inaccessible, and the two guys went up there and were beheaded or something?
No, that's way up. That's the McLeods up in the Nahanni Valley. That's up in the Yukon. That's the legend of the lost, the howling Shangri-La Valley. A lot of guys have been beheaded up there. The Headless Valley, it's called. It's a big deal to Canadians. Story of the Nahanni. Several prospectors have never come back or been found. Their bones have been found. They were beheaded looking for the lost McLeod that the two McLeod brothers supposedly found.
Beheaded.
The two guys you're thinking of, yes, they were beheaded in their sleep.
By humans?
Well, they're supposed to be mountain men up there, cave type men, according to the Indians. They've drawn that on animal hides, what they've seen up there. And huge mammoth-type things that they said the grizzlies are supposed to be huge up there, and the Chinook winds come through the valley. This is by the Mackenzies. There's a Shangri-La Valley, it's called. It really does exist. It's almost a tropical, semi-tropical valley, 5 degrees from the Arctic Circle because of the volcanic pools, the steam baths. One expedition did get up there from University of Pennsylvania or something, the Norman expedition. And the delphiniums grew to 8 feet tall, and the grapes were like duck eggs, and oh, it was described as grand, all the flowers and the birds over this valley, but it's a lost valley. You can't find it that often. That's supposedly the center of the mystery. That would be the lost Nahanni.
Like
two guys you're talking about are those two Fresno guys, the Blakeney brothers or something, in the 1930s that went looking for Sasquatch at Morris Mountain, and they came back all emaciated. J.W. Burns was describing that expedition.
Well, what else can you tell us, John, about things that you've heard, things that you may know? I'm sorry.
About Bigfoot?
Yeah. I mean,
well,
we
I
know,
document
I mean,
everything I feel is most accurate in the book. I take everybody through it historically. So I start at, you know, day one to see, you know, to show everybody where falsehood started being piled up, where the folklore started taking over.
Get everybody
back to the original image.
Is your book available?
Yes, it is. Amazon is playing tricks with it, but it's available at Barnes & Noble, but Amazon will say it is not in stock, and that is not true. Whatever their problem is, a small publisher, so they were selected, as others were, along with Hachette, to be messed with, and that's the book they selected of mine, and they say it's out of print, but it is most definitely in stock at every other bookseller. And frankly, if you ordered it on Amazon, you'd get it in a very quick period of time, despite it saying it's out of stock. They don't say it's out of print. They say it's out of stock. But if you ordered it on Amazon, it would still go through.
BarnesandNoble.com. What I'm going to do is I'm going to...
You can order it in a store, whatever.
I'm going to go and I'm going to post the link on our group page. For everyone, if they're interested, I'm definitely interested in picking it up.
You can order it off Amazon. If they get orders, they will ship it right away, despite it saying that it is out of stock. It is not. That is not true. Or you can order it from Barnes & Noble's, Powell's, Books A Million, whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to post.
When I first came across the book, it's really what drew me back into the subject, because I'd been into it for a long time when I was a kid and had slowly been getting back into it. And then the more that I started listening to a lot of shows and reading some of the books, it started to turn me off, because there was basically almost no new information. And it was all mostly people talking about the gear that they used in the woods, and sometimes just about sightings and these habituation sites where there's no documentation. People are seeing them like every day, interacting with whole families. There's no documentation of any kind. And it just, to me, was turning me off to the whole thing, because it was like, you know, you mean to tell me there's nothing solid or even vaguely interesting since the Patterson film until I came across this book, and all of a sudden someone had a fresh idea that actually made some sort of linear sense. And it's hard to describe the scope of the book. I mean, John, even he's gone into aspects of it, but there's an awful lot more to it. I mean, I think it's very interesting reading. It's exhaustively researched. And, you know, I still read a lot of the other books. I mostly go back to the older books. I've been reading John Green's books again, Ivan Sanderson's books, John Napier. And this is all stuff that was written 40 years ago. And the newer books, some other than Meldrum's book, there's really not a lot of stuff new that has much to tell you. There's things like Raincoast Sasquatch is really good, has interesting accounts and things, but some of them you pick up and it's complete drivel, you know. So, I mean, I'd suggest it for anyone who wants to really get a thinking man's take on the Bigfoot thing, someone who knows the history and actually is making connections that haven't been made before. And the interesting thing is, after I read his book, I started to notice a lot of people in the field were adopting some of his ideas, but not even giving him credit for the things that he'd come up with. All of a sudden, everyone was believing that there's all these different variations within this prospective species and things that no one had said before. And
what people don't realize about Gene, is Gene is, like, so knowledgeable regarding all this.
I follow a lot of it. Granted, there's a certain degree, there's a certain amount of it I discard, because it doesn't, you know, obviously I have my opinions on the subject, so there's certain things that I don't buy into. So I have my biases as well, but I stick within the realms of what I believe represents a biological species. And there's enough variation within those theories to keep you busy all day long, without getting into all of the crazy supernatural stuff, you know. But, you know, I'm surprised and shocked many times when I talk to people that don't read any of these books. They completely rely on just going out in the forest and playing Dungeons & Dragons. And that's fine. It's just, you know, if you're going to study something that either some sort of primate, whether that's a human primate or some sort of ape, you should be doing some back reading on anthropology. Study gorillas, study chimpanzees, because a lot of the behavior of these animals that I hear different people say they display, like rock throwing and the stick stuff and breaking off branches, those are traits that apes will display. And things like the bluff charges and things. You can learn so much by doing some back reading on monkeys and gorillas and pre-human history, and I don't think very many people actually do that. You know, it's just they're kind of camping trips with, like, the lore of, you know, like they said, the D&D thing thrown over it. I don't get that. Granted, I'm speaking from the perspective of an armchair enthusiast. So who am I to throw stones? But I'll throw them anyway.
Well, my book has proven very influential, but people don't want to push the point, I think, to raise the debate, because so many do just love the legend. Legend of the single cone-headed giant. The legend of that they're this close to the missing link, and they're going to ennoble this whole camp out by saying they're going to get the true subhuman or something.
And then you have all these
that's
stupid.
Not what I talk about.
And then you have all these stupid
really
television shows. Yeah, you have all
right,
these stupid television shows pushing it.
With all the television I've done on other subjects, you know, I've never been asked to do a Bigfoot show. I have never appeared. I have never spoken on television about Bigfoot, ever.
You are the redheaded stepchild of Bigfoot, John. That's the problem.
Yeah,
I guess
you don't.
So, even though I'm the newer guys really like me. I've really influenced so many people, as I say, but it's not a subject that people wish to push and cause a lot of contention, because it's going to push a lot of the true armchair. People just want to sit around and make it up. They don't want to read anything. They just want to believe in the legend. They want to believe in the gospel of Bigfoot and not the facts.
The fantasy,
A lot of the books are simply the gospel of Bigfoot. The gospel is a collection of vignettes out to prove whatever it wishes to prove, and that's what a lot of the books on Bigfoot are, just vignettes. And if you don't believe everyone that has become accepted in the folklore, if you don't believe the Mount St. Helens story, if you don't believe the Patterson film, you are a heretic. It's like saying you believe in Jesus, but you don't believe the water into wine episode. You are a heretic.
Yeah.
And they, it's
the
a religion
is,
to them.
I mean,
this is the gospel.
In any spirit of investigation, whether you are a scientist or whether you're, like me, just an enthusiast, I think that if you discard anything without definitive evidence, then you're hampering your own ability to understand the subject. That's why I try to absorb as much as I can. Like I said, there's certain things I just won't buy into, you know, because I have my preconceived notion is that, you know, we're dealing with an animal. We're not dealing with some sort of an alien, you know, construct or supernatural being, but just within it being a real animal, I mean, I could have to look at everything, but I don't know if people are necessarily even researching to a large degree. I mean, there's some people, I talk to a lot of people, there's some people that legitimately are, they really know the folklore, they know the old stories, they know all about the different things through the 1800s with the what is it and the apes and the Jacko story and all that. And then there's people I talk to that have no clue about any of it. They literally just go out in the woods and look for impressions in the ground. And every noise, tree break, and snap in the woods is a Bigfoot sneaking up on them. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just, you know, in a field where people are striving for scientific recognition, and it's, you know, this is the resurgence of the age of the citizen naturalist. And when you're striving for scientific recognition, everything that you do that flies in the face of that is going to be judged even more harshly. And, you know, so all those things are working against this ever being recognized. And the legitimate scientists like Jeff Meltham, who are actually working towards trying to bring this into focus as a real pursuit, everything that these people are doing is going against that. They're making it that much more difficult. No matter how you want to describe the creature, something's going on. People are seeing something. What that is specifically, only evidence of, you know, a nature of a body is going to prove it either way. But the way a lot of people are going about it is just, you know, and you can't really blame the TV shows. I think the TV shows are great, because they keep it in the public eye. They keep it a part of pop culture, which brings money to the subject, which, you know, look at Brian Sykes. Obviously, he must have had some sort of interest in the subject. But the only reason that he got the opportunity to do a TV show is that it's really hot right now. And so somebody came up to him and said, we want to do a show. and he must have been interested in it, and it happened, and then you get a legit genetic scientist involved in the equation. But unless, you know, it's a follow-the-money situation. You know, you have to have money to do a serious expedition. You have to have money to do any kind of genetic investigation or any of these things if you're testing hair samples or whatever it is. You know, right now, it's a lot of enthusiastic people out doing the citizen naturalist thing to varying degrees of success or professionalism. And that's commendable. It's just, I don't think that's not necessarily what takes us to the final answer to the mystery, though. You know, that's why I don't think you can discard anything that makes any kind of a sense or that gets you thinking in a new direction. You know, because like you're saying, I mean, it's a lot of the folklore has come to a point where it so revolves around a handful of famous stories and descriptions that it's almost become like a comic book origin story. You change the origin of Batman, and all of a sudden all the fanboys freak out. It's the same thing with Bigfoot.
Right.
If you suggest even something slightly outside of what everyone's accepted as doctrine, they flip out, you know, and it shouldn't be like that. There should be room, just like in science, as stiff and rigid as science can be, it flexes when new solid data comes in. They have to change their opinion of things. It has to, but it has to come with some solid proof.
There's a difference between people who really look for Bigfoot and the chills and thrills crowd who wish to go out and get their slice of campfire Americana and simply say, "I was looking for Bigfoot."
Right.
Yeah, there was
a lot of people that go out are just that chills and thrill crowd, and that's why they don't take any preparation, because they don't really last. This is just a fun camp out for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's for the adrenaline rush. You know, it's for the adrenaline rush, and you know, it's interesting. Is just today I was telling Gene, I was like, man, you know, I don't have that fear anymore when I go out there. You know, and that may be a good thing, but then again, it could be a bad thing. I'm just, you know, I hear things, I see eye shine, I'm walking towards the eye shine without even, you know, before I even realize what I'm doing, I'm halfway in the woods walking towards, you know, whatever's eye shining out there. I'm just, you know, instinctively walking towards it. I just don't have that fear. You know, I hear things, it doesn't startle me, doesn't make me jump or anything like that. And you know, I go out there, like I said, almost every night, and there is a difference, and I know certain people who go out there for the thrill of it. You know, they instantly think, oh, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to get my own TV show off of this, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. You know, it's like, you know, I've said this many times before, I'm not out to prove to the world that Sasquatch or Bigfoot exist. You know, I'm out to experience it myself, you know, to understand more about them and hopefully get a close encounter to where I, as an artist, can see their face well enough to sketch it or sculpt it or whatever and say, this is what definitively it looks like, at least the one that I've seen. You know, the rest of the world can go out there the same as I'm doing and you know, go out there in the middle of the night in the middle of the woods and find out for themselves if they want to know that, you know, that they exist.
I'm afraid most people don't have that attitude. However, it's like I said, it's part of Campfire Americana. They figure they don't have to do any study because when they see something out of the ordinary, they're sure they found it. And so why should they?
That's right.
They do any study because obviously
right.
This is it. This doesn't fit with. It's not a bear. It's not a horse. It's not whatever. This has got to be Bigfoot.
Gene and I talked about that
whatever
today
they
as well.
See is Bigfoot.
You know, people get in their head anything out there that they can't understand. If they don't actually, like trees, for example, bend over trees, if they don't see it happen or how it happened, it's instantly Sasquatch did it. You know, and it's really sad. You know, it's like that adage. You know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, does it make a sound? You know, for some people who go out there, some researchers, if a tree is bent over and there's no one around, then obviously a Sasquatch did it. Or if a tree is broken and no one's around, then obviously a Sasquatch did it. And to me, that's very foolish. That's not true research, in my opinion. If you don't go through the steps and the processes of eliminating what it could have been naturally, then you know you're totally 100% biased. Everything is a Sasquatch, and you know lose credibility, in my opinion. You know, of people who go out there and it's like, oh, well, look at this leaf. It's bent an opposite direction than the rest of them. It had to be a Sasquatch. Yeah, there's a thousand other explanations for stuff like that other than Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And to jump to those conclusions just right off the bat, I don't see it as being accurate research.
And the problem with it is that really the responsibility for proving that this thing actually exists, whatever form it may take, it's really on the burden is on the Bigfoot community, because the people that are doing that, they're the only ones looking. There's not a concerted scientific effort of any kind or anything with seriously big money behind it like the old Tom Slick days that John was talking about before. So it's the onus is on the people in the community to go out there and prove this. And, you know, because otherwise no one else cares. Other than it being a cool monster in those crappy sci-fi channel movies, it will get no other attention as any kind of a legitimate pursuit until it's actually proven. So any kind of work that's being done, all the half-assed stuff, if it's not hurting anybody if people are out there camping and, you know, doing whatever, but the nonsense that goes on in the community actually hurts the thing at large. You know,
that's
the
right.
Whole
you know,
thing,
if
the sniping at each other, it just draws attention away from the idea itself. And I think a lot of people they want the attention rather than the attention to the pursuit itself. I think that's why you see a lot of it.
And we all get kind of categorized. We all get kind of categorized with that same group. You know, if I go out there and I don't have any kind of howls, any wood knocks, any eye shine, any kind of encounter while I'm out there, then that doesn't bother me because I'm still out there. I love being out there. It's peaceful. It's relaxing. I enjoy it. I'm still having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sadly, not everyone could think of that, you know, or look at it in that light.
Well, I think it's dangerous if you go out there every single time with the intention of coming back with evidence by hook or by crook, because then you tend to see things that aren't there, and on the more malevolent side, it actually manufactures things and makes things up, if not just see them, you know, wishfully.
Which goes back to some of the things that we were talking earlier when we talked about how the whole interdimensional cloaking, zapping, those types of things come into play. Is you know you start making excuses and you start making up these stories because you feel like you have to prove that you know you don't want to come back empty-handed, basically.
Yeah.
So, anyway, let me see. We're winding down. John, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. Gene, thanks for co-hosting.
Thanks for having me.
It was very,
yeah, it was very good to talk to you in person, well, pseudo in person, John.
It was very informative.
You.
I mean, I love hearing the history of Sasquatch and Bigfoot. And, you know, I've always been a firm believer, as you said, that there's more than one type or species, if you will, running around in the forest. I've always believed that. And, you know, the things you said kind of confirmed a lot of that for me.
Well, without history, we're just dealing with factoids. We have to put the whole context. Context is everything. If what's being seen today was being seen back then, we have solid continuity and comparative analysis. But if we just start where we first hear something, we're just forever dealing with factoids. And we've divorced it from the entire context of the phenomenon.
Well, you know, unfortunately, not everyone goes and looks at the history. You know, you know, a lot of people think that this is all a modern thing, you know, with the television shows and stuff like that. They don't realize that, and I've had so many conversations with different people about this, they don't realize that these stories, these legends go way, way back. And when they do, you know, when you do tell them, when they do come to that realization, you know, you can just see the look on their face change. It's like, wow, I didn't know that. You know, and, you know, one of the things I say more than anything to people is, you know, do your homework. You know, a lot of people, you know, they want to go out there and they're like, what is the one thing, you know, what would you tell someone who wants to get into this and start doing it? Do your homework, know the history, know your local wildlife, and use common sense.
That's why I wrote Recasting Bigfoot to restart it all over. That's why it's called Recasting Bigfoot, getting the true image back, so we can start from there, instead of just adding everything to a very questionable folkloric image.
Now, real quick, before we go off, do you have plans to continue your writings?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there will be. There's more writings coming up on other topics, but I do plan, as my expeditions Pacific Northwest and Siberia expands, that I would be writing more, you know, updates and sequels and so forth. Might do a little pamphlet like Green used to do. And then if anything, a lot of stuff comes up, I'll do another book on it.
That's awesome. Keep me posted, definitely. And, you know, I'd be more than happy to let you promote and come on the show and so forth.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on. And stay safe out there, you know, especially when you go on these expeditions.
Thank you much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John. You have a great night.
All right. Talk to you guys later. Thanks again, John.
Okay,
see you, Brian.